Hey everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast and I am Marcus. I don't want to beat around the bush today. We have a great guest, a really great guest. A guest who has made global headlines when an object appeared in our solar system in 2017. He formulated a rather bold thesis, committing scientific sacrilege. Remember the unpronounceable name Oumuamua? A bit as unpronounceable as Eyjafjallajökull. I know I butchered that one right now. Sorry for my ignorance, Iceland. But they say it has got to end with that, to my tongue, rather difficult k sound. Anyway, we're of course talking about the Icelandic volcano that paralyzed European air traffic in 2010. Oumuamua, though, was a strange rock that suddenly appeared in our solar system as if from nowhere, only to suddenly disappear again. That called all the with astro starting scientists on the plan. Of course, what an opportunity. Theories were developed and dumped, explanations discussed, but none turned out really interesting. That was reason enough for our guest today to openly state the obvious explanation, that the boulder or rock or whatever it was probably not a boulder, but an interstellar object of non-human origin. The bomb detonated and the shockwaves spread far beyond astrophysics. Not because there might be something to the outrageous claim, but because such a thing is not claimed, certainly not by a scientist.
Do you want me to record the audio on my smartphone? No problem. Let me do that.
The dust had not even settled. Our guest followed up with a popular science book, which immediately landed on the bestseller list. And of course, our guest has a name, and that name is Avi Loeb.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Theoretical physicist, astrophysicist, and cosmologist at the prestigious Harvard University. Let's go. Avi, to what extent did the extraordinary comment you made at the end of your paper harm your career? Or did it at all? Well, let me put it that way. How did it feel to hit the send button once the paper was finished?
Nothing unusual, because I followed my childhood curiosity. That's the way I enjoy doing science. You know, I don't care how many likes I have on Twitter, or I just follow what basketball coaches often say, keep your eyes on the ball, not on the audience. And, you know, it's the evidence that guides me, as it should in the context of science. And, you know, I'm willing to put some skin in the game. You know, kids very often put skin in the game. They get bruised, literally speaking. So I don't mind getting bruised, because that's the fun of doing science, learning something new about reality, making predictions and testing against the evidence. You know, that's the fun. And it's such an exciting question. How can scientists avoid it? That's the thing I don't understand.
Right, beautiful. Has it done any harm to you, like major harm to you as a scientist, the public?
Not at all, actually. Most of my scientific work is done independently of others. You know, I come up with ideas and I follow on them, and I'm just limited by the amount of time I have during the day. And, you know, I jog at 5 a.m. in the morning, and then when I have the time, I just work. And therefore, I don't need anybody to be next to me or to, you know, socialize with me. And I don't spend any time on social media whatsoever. And so as far as I'm concerned, actually, the last 10 months were the most productive in my career because of the pandemic, because I didn't have to travel to my office at work. I saved the commute. And I also didn't have to explain to myself why my colleagues are saying things that do not make any sense. You know, so I could dedicate all my time to creative work. And I wrote papers and essays and got my book published. And I have another book coming up, a textbook on the same subject of searching for extraterrestrial life. The textbook is more than 1,000 pages long, and it includes both the search for primitive life, microbial life, as well as the search for intelligent life, technological signatures. And it has been such a productive time for me, and I really enjoy going out to nature every morning and in the company of ducks and rabbits and birds. That's much more pleasant than being surrounded by, colleagues in academia that are mostly interested in promoting their image.
Avi, thank you so much for your honesty. And I think this is something that matters very much these days, to be honest about one's own work and honest about one's own feelings. So let's talk about Oumuamua. Where did it come from? Why was it of interest to you, and where is it now?
Right. So this was the first object that was spotted near Earth that came from outside the solar system. And it was discovered by a telescope in Hawaii called Pan-STARRS and given a Hawaiian name, Oumuamua, which means a scout in the Hawaiian language, messenger from far away. And it's like finding an object from the street in your backyard, and you wonder, what does it tell you about the street that you live in? Because if you don't make the trip, it could save you that travel time, and you can learn about your environment. And It turns out that this object was extremely weird. It looked nothing like we have seen before in our backyard in the solar system. Didn't look like a comet or an asteroid. And it became so weird in my mind that I contemplated the possibility of an artificial origin for it.
Why was it of interest when it comes to its weirdness?
Yeah, because it didn't quite line up with what we expect for a comet or an asteroid. You know, I left a seminar room after a lecture about this object, and together with me was a colleague that worked on rocks from the solar system for decades. And he said, Oumuamua is so weird, I wish it never existed. And to me, that was appalling, because a scientist should be thrilled at the opportunity to study something new that doesn't quite conform with what you expected, because it's a learning experience and you learn something new that's exciting. It's nature's way of telling you that what you thought about before is incorrect and you have to revise your preconception. So I see that as a very exciting moment when experiments do not match up what we expected. And this object really had about six anomalies, which I describe in my book. One of them was that it didn't look like a comet. It didn't have a cometary tail, didn't have gas around it. Another one was that it had a very extreme shape. Based on the variation of light as it was tumbling, one can infer that it was at least 10 times longer than it was wide, projected on the sky, and most likely pancake-shaped. And then it was pushed away from the sun by some force, which in my mind can only be the reflection of sunlight that gives it an extra push. For that, it needed to be very thin, sort of like a sail. And the problem is nature doesn't produce sails. In fact, just a few months ago, we saw an object that also exhibited an extra push away from the sun by reflecting sunlight and didn't have any cometary tail. Turns out that object, which was discovered also by Pan-STARRS, the same telescope, is a rocket booster from a launch in 1966 to the moon. And it was hollow and thin, and that's why it had a lot of area for its weight, sort of like a sail. And it shared the same properties of Oumuamua. So this one we know was definitely artificial because we made it. The question is, who made Oumuamua?
Very interesting. So how detailed a picture did you get from the telescopes?
Right. So the object was only about 100, 200 meters large, so roughly the size of a football field. And from Earth, we couldn't really resolve it with our telescopes. It was like a point of light with a changing brightness, of course, but we couldn't really get an image of it. And here lies the lesson. My point is, if we realize that weird objects are coming our way, it's sort of like finding a plastic bottle on the beach. You know, most of the time you find the rock on the beach. But when you find a plastic bottle, it tells you there is a civilization out there. So the next thing for us to do is look for more plastic bottles. Basically, deploy cameras within the orbit of the Earth around the sun, a lot of them. And then when the next one comes along, one of the cameras would be close to its orbit, and then we could get a close-up photo. And they say, you know, that the picture is worth 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. Actually, in my case, a picture is worth 66,000 words, which is the number of words in my book. I wouldn't need to write the book if I had a picture.
Mm-hmm. Let me put it this way. Usually, we humans tend to seek explanations in the metaphysical or in the realm of the gods if we do not have explanations for things. So we're obviously lacking an explanation for that weird thing that appeared on the sky in 2017. So what makes you so sure that this is not just another version of us lacking an explanation? This is why we either ask the gods or the aliens to be responsible for it.
Well, so I operate just like a detective, you know, like Sherlock Holmes or any other detective. Basically, I put all possibilities on the table in terms of explanations. And then I look at the possibilities on the table and I decide which one looks most compelling. Now, of course, it's possible that our imagination is limited and there is another possibility that we haven't thought about. But what can we do? You know, given the possibilities we put on the table, that's what I select. So I'm a practical person. I don't care about hypothetical possibilities that might be out there and we haven't even thought about them. You know, it's sort of like coming to a crime scene and you have a certain number of suspects, okay? Now, it's possible that there is another person that actually did the crime, but given the suspects, you select the one that looks most plausible and you try to collect more evidence that will nail down the appropriate person. But so at any event, what are the possibilities that were put on the table? So I put first the artificial origin because it didn't look like an asteroid or a comet. And then other scientists in the subsequent couple of years came up with only a few other possibilities. And those were a hydrogen iceberg, a chunk of frozen hydrogen that evaporates, but you can't see the cometary tail because hydrogen is transparent. The problem with that is that a hydrogen iceberg would get evaporated along its path, along its journey. And so it wouldn't survive the journey, and therefore it's unlikely to be the explanation. Then there was a suggestion of a cloud of dust particles, very loosely bound, sort of a very porous object that is 100 times less dense than air. And the problem with that is when it gets such an object gets as close as Oumuamua was from the sun, it will get heated by hundreds of degrees. And I just have a hard time believing that such a porous structure, a cloud that is 100 times less dense than air, could sustain heating by hundreds of degrees and maintain its integrity with the material strength that it could have. And then there was another possibility. Maybe it's a small piece out of a bigger object that was disrupted by a star. And the problem with that is that such a shrapnel would be elongated, cigar-shaped, instead of being pancake-shaped, like we inferred for this object. And also the chance of passing close to a star is very small. So altogether, you know, given those alternatives, I concluded that the artificial origin is a real possibility and potentially the most likely among them. Now, many of my colleagues, those that criticize this possibility, they didn't attempt to explain the anomalies in a different way. I mean, I'm just looking at the evidence and at the possibilities that people put on the table. That's the way I operate.
Assuming it's an alien spacecraft, it must have appeared in our solar system for some reason. So would it be possible?
Not necessarily, because you can imagine, just like plastic bottles on the beach, you know, you sit on the beach and suddenly you see a plastic bottle next to your feet. There was no reason that this particular plastic bottle that may have holes in it, sort of like junk or garbage, you know, floating on the ocean, would just arrive next to your leg. There is no reason for that, but it did. And of course, you can calculate the chance of that happening depending on the number of plastic bottles per unit area. The same thing here. It's possible that there are lots of objects like Oumuamua, and just one of them we noticed this time around, you know.
So, I mean, like, that could be a fun way to think about it, to see it as a piece of alien trash.
Well, originally, it may have not been a trash because, for example, we sent out the Voyager 1, Voyager 2, and the New Horizons and other spacecraft out of the solar system. And just think about the fact that the sun is a relative latecomer. So there were most of the stars in the Milky Way galaxy formed billions of years before the sun. So if they had civilizations that are like ours, that send out equipment, after a few billion years, that equipment will not be functional anymore. You know, it will not operate. It will, you can call it trash, but originally it was used for a purpose. So I would not be surprised if space is full of objects that perhaps were useful once, but not anymore. And these are mostly billion years old objects. And by looking for them, by finding those relics, you can learn about civilizations that are dead by now and existed in the distant past. Mm-hmm. Just like the Mayan civilization on Earth, you know, we know about its existence from the relics it left behind. We cannot have a phone conversation with the Mayans. They are not around anymore. In the past, people searched for radio signals, which are sort of like a phone conversation. But my point is that this method is very restrictive because mm-hmm. it requires the counterpart to be alive when you want to listen to a phone conversation. I mean, most of the civilizations may be dead by now.
Given that Oumuamua, when it passed through our solar system, was still active, and I'm not saying that someone is alive on board, but let's just assume it was active. Would it be possible for us to measure signatures of any scans or other forms of observation on the part of the extraterrestrials?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it was active, of course, there is the possibility that we would detect a signal coming from it. And actually, we decided to look about a week after it was noticed. We decided to check whether there is any radio signal coming from it. We didn't see anything at the level of a cell phone, about less than a watt per coming from it. But of course, it may not be beamed in our direction. It also may not be sent at the time that we were looking, and maybe not at the frequencies that we are looking. We don't know much about it. And that's why, you know, the best way to proceed would be to find another one that shares those weird properties. And this time around, we would get close to it and try to monitor what's going on. And how does it look? Does it really look like something different than a rock?
Avi, to be super honest, I'm a little perplexed about the discourse we're having here. Why is it so difficult to discuss such thoughts publicly in our society?
It's not public. I would say my book is receiving an extraordinary response from the general public. You know, it became a bestseller in multiple countries the first week that it came out. And obviously the public is extremely interested and supportive. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of emails like every day.
As opposed to the academic world.
So the skepticism is in the academic world. And part of it is because there is a culture of unidentified flying objects that is not substantiated by scientific evidence, and also science fiction. And so some scientists feel that they would degrade their image if they were to participate in a conversation on this subject. Mm-hmm. And in my view, it's untrue, because if you remember from ancient history, humans thought that the body has a soul and therefore should not be operated. And imagine if scientists were saying, oh, there shouldn't be anatomy of the human body because there is all this nonsense being said by amateurs about it. I think it would make little sense, because all the medicine, benefits we have from modern medicine will be lost in that process. And I think scientists should address any topic, especially a topic of great interest to the public, using the scientific method, collecting data and using evidence to guide them, rather than shy away from it. As of now, there is not much funding. You know, it's 1,000 times less than funding, for example, the search for dark matter in the universe. Most of the matter in the universe, we don't know what it is. And we were searching in the dark, looking for some specific particles, and we haven't found them. And why would such a search that has no direct influence on our private lives, you know, if the dark matter is a weakly interacting massive particle, or if it's an axion, it will change nothing about human life on Earth. I mean, who cares, frankly? I mean, of course, from an academic perspective, it's good to know what particle it is, but it will have zero influence on our life. However, if we answer the question, is there a smarter kid on the block? If we find evidence for a technological relic that tells us here is a piece of technology, some equipment that is made of components that are far more advanced than we developed in our history, that would have a huge influence on our thinking. And so how is it possible that the scientific community will not try to collect this evidence with at least as much resources? I'm not talking about a factor of 2 increase in the funding, but a factor of 1,000 increase in the funding. at least as much resources as dedicated to the search of dark matter, if not more. And why should it be ridiculed to be outside the mainstream? It should be exactly central to the mainstream because the public is so interested in that and the public funds science.
Avi, let's talk about the probability of extraterrestrial intelligent life. So Lisa Kaltenecker from the Carl Sagan Institute once blew my mind when she compared the number of stars in our observable universe to the number of every grain of sand and gravel on Earth combined. I mean, if this does not blow one's mind, what else does? But even more interesting, most of those stars have planets around them. So considering that huge number of possibilities, life in the universe is less a miracle, but a necessity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so after studying decades the sky, the biggest message that I got is a sense of cosmic modesty. We need to be humble because we tend to think that we are really at the center of the universe, that we are unique and special. And that's understandable because when I looked at my daughters when they were infants, you know, they tended to think that they're at the center of the world and they thought that they're the smartest. And the only way they changed that misconception is by going to the kindergarten and seeing kids that are smarter than they are. And so that's my point, that our civilization will mature only when it finds others. And we started with Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher, who argued that we are at the center of the universe. And of course, that was very flattering to the ego of many people, and it was the accepted view for 1,000 years. But then Galileo and Copernicus convinced us that, based on evidence, that actually the Earth moves around the sun. And philosophers at the time of Galileo just refused to look through his telescope and put him in house arrest. That only maintained their ignorance. And of course, it didn't change the reality that the Earth moves around the sun. Reality doesn't care if we ignore it. And so my point is, we have to learn a lesson from that, that we are not at the center of the action. And moreover, we are not unique and special. What we find in our backyard, the Earth-Sun system, is very common. It's about half of all the sun-like stars have a planet like the Earth, at the size of the Earth and at the same distance of the Earth from the Sun. And if you arrange for similar circumstances, why wouldn't you get similar outcomes? I think the starting assumption, the default assumption, should be that we are not unique, we are not privileged. Mm-hmm. Stop thinking that we are so special that we don't even need to search, because that's what my colleagues say. They say, you know, show me extraordinary evidence that there is anyone out there, and then I'll start the discussion. It should be exactly the opposite. The opposite view, saying it must be very common because we are modest and we see the same circumstances reproduced in billions of other places within the Milky Way galaxy. And as a result, let's go and search. That is the obvious mainstream common sense that should be there. However, it's exactly in the opposite place right now. It's being ridiculed and pushed aside. And I just don't understand why would the academic community not embrace it, because the public is so interested and it would excite so many young scientists to enter the search and look for signatures like that.
But still the question remains, where is everyone, Avi? Of course, I'm referring to physicist Enrico Fermi here, who at the Los Alamos Nuclear Testing Facility reportedly asked himself where all the aliens are when his colleagues showed him the cartoon in the New Yorker about aliens invading New York City. So where is everyone?
Well, so I think this question by itself shows a lot of arrogance, because it implies that we deserve a visit. And, you know, if we are just like ants on a sidewalk, there are many like us that existed for billions of years and we are nothing special. Then why would, you know, when you walk down the street, why would you pay special tribute to every ant? I would think that we are not sufficiently interesting for anyone to even notice us. And when I met my wife, she had a lot of friends that were waiting for Prince Charming on a white horse to show up at the doorstep and make them a marriage proposal. And that never happened. And, you know, only when you think that you're that special, you would expect them to be here and having a party with you. And why would they do that? It's not at all clear to me that we are that significant. And only over the past 100 years or so, we had technologies that merit some attention. But it's a short time. And before that, we were just like animals, kind of not very sophisticated technologically. So, you know, I think that we are just not significant. And that's the starting point. And if you start with that, you also want to find them rather than them finding you. And because you can learn from them if they are much more advanced than we are. We can find a technology that is a million years old and we can copy it and use it, import it to Earth. And probably you can make a lot of money out of that. And most importantly, it could save us a million years. You know, it's worth it.
So why has SETI found nothing so far? They've been looking around for quite a while.
Yeah, because it used the wrong approach. It was looking for radio signals. And radio signals are just like a phone conversation. You need the counterpart to be alive. But most of the civilizations are dead by now because they existed billions of years ago, and maybe they are short-lived. So if they live only for a few centuries as technological civilizations capable of radio transmissions, you have a very small chance of that one of them will be alive at the time that you're looking. And therefore, the better approach to search is look for relics. That's what archaeology is all about, looking for cultures that existed on Earth in the past. So we can do exactly the same thing in space. And I call that space archaeology. I discuss it in my book. Basically looking for relics floating in space, like Oumuamua, things that come from outside the solar system, left behind, you know, by earlier civilizations.
What else could be a relic of another intelligent civilization? For example, like on Earth, we leave behind quite a bit of trash, also nuclear trash. So would that be some sort of a cultural relic you're talking about?
Yeah, it could be all kinds of relics. It could be even industrial pollution in the atmospheres of planets around other stars, which we can search for. I wrote a paper about it 6 years ago where we predicted that if a planet has 100 times the pollution that we produce with our industries, then you might be able to search for that with the James Webb Space Telescope for planets transiting white dwarfs, a special type of stellar remnants. And the point is, in addition to relics floating in space, you can look for things around planets. Aside from industrial pollution, you can look for example, for artificial lights on the dark side of a planet. And you can look for reflectance from photovoltaic cells on the day side of a planet and all kinds of technological imprints that would not exist naturally. And to me, that's a clearer path towards finding evidence for life, because if you're searching for oxygen in the atmosphere of a planet, it's not necessarily indicative of life, because the Earth didn't have oxygen in its atmosphere in the first 2 billion years. So for half of its life, the oxygen levels were low, even though there was a lot of microbial life on the surface of Earth. And therefore, if you don't find oxygen, it doesn't tell you that there is no microbial life. If you do find oxygen, it also doesn't tell you that there is microbial life, because you can make oxygen by natural processes. So if you do find, for example, industrial pollution, CFC molecules, nature doesn't make such molecules. So that would be not only indicative of industrial civilizations, but also of life more generally.
Do you, when you leave your office late at night and go home, ever dream about what shape that alien civilization could have? Like, what could alien life look like? Does it necessarily look like the intelligent life or the life we are used to seeing, or what do you think?
I think not at all. I think we will be shocked when we either meet primitive life, you know, biological life, or the technological relics. Because, you know, when you go on a date with someone, then there is a common genetic heritage with that person that you share, I mean, as a human. But when you meet life from another planet that had no connection with our planet, it could be completely off, something very different, unlike what we have seen before. Just to give you an example, the nearest star to Earth, to the sun is called Proxima Centauri. And that is a dwarf star. Most of the stars in the Milky Way are much smaller than the sun. They are about 10%, a tenth of the mass of the sun. And Proxima Centauri is one of them. It's 12% of the mass of the sun. And it has half the surface temperature. So instead of emitting visible light like the sun does, it emits infrared light. And we developed eyes that are sensitive to visible light because that's the most common resource the sun supplies us with. And so when this light bounces off objects, it helps us survive, because in the old days, if there was a tiger around you and you wanted to escape the risk, then you would use the reflected light from the tiger and escape, because you would recognize that it's approaching you. And so we have eyes that are sensitive to the light that the sun provides, visible light. But if there are any creatures on the planet near Proxima Centauri, and there is a planet in the habitable zone called Proxima B, then those creatures would have infrared eyes. And just think about interstellar tourist agencies when they advertise vacations. They will never advertise vacations on Earth to those creatures because the visible light would hurt their eyes. Mm-hmm. And they're used to dark red grass on their vacation sites. And all we can offer is green grass on our vacation sites. So they will never find that attractive. So they will never come to see us. And the only way for us to get their attention would be to go there and entice them to come and visit us with a water-based drink.
So the interstellar tourist agency would then put on their panels or advertisements, infrared tourists only and whatnot.
By the way, there is an interesting point about aliens coming here, because if they arrive at the airport, they will have to fill in the track and trace forms, and they would not be happy about that. Also, there is an issue of whether they will be legally aliens or illegal aliens.
Right. So I think we could say that we're potentially surrounded by intelligent life, but lack the sensorium to observe it. So it would be a little like when we search for quasars and exoplanets, which were postulated for a long time, and we did not find them for the longest time, not because they do not exist, but because we lack the tools to make them visible. Right. And with the development of new observation methods, the objects suddenly appeared, and in such numbers that one can almost assume that space is teeming with Earth-like planets. So would it be somewhat similar to that?
Yes, I think so. The situation is similar to gravitational wave astronomy. There was the LIGO detector developed over decades, and it didn't have enough sensitivity to see any event for decades. But then in 2015, it reached the needed sensitivity, and once it opened its eyes to the sky, very shortly afterwards, within the first month, there was this amazing event discovered of two black holes colliding at the edge of the universe. Mm-hmm. And then after that, of course, there was a flood of other events. And so once you reach a certain level of sensitivity required to detect something, you might see that these things are quite common. It's just that you weren't able to detect them in the first place. And I completely agree with you. That may well be the situation, that the interstellar space is humming with signals, and we just either didn't tune to the appropriate type of signal, or perhaps didn't have the sensitivity so far.
So would that also mean that any discovery of intelligent extraterrestrial life is less a matter of time and more a matter of technology? So if we would discover aliens now, it doesn't mean that alien life exists by chance only now, but that we have the technological abilities to see it only now. In all probability, it has already existed for millions of years.
Or billions.
But we lack the billions of years.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what happened with Oumuamua. The Pan-STARRS telescope that found it was just started operation a few years earlier. And before that, we just didn't have the capacity to detect an object like that, because you need to survey the sky with some sensitivity, and we just didn't have such a thing. This telescope was aimed to find near-Earth or objects that are of risk to us, which was a task that the U.S. Congress gave NASA, to find 90% of all objects bigger than 140 meters. Which is roughly the size of Oumuamua. And so in the process of surveying the sky, Pan-STARRS found this object that happened to come from outside the solar system. It's not a rock the way we anticipated, but it's exciting. And it's exactly along the lines that you said. We wouldn't find it if we didn't have the capacity, the technological equipment that can find it. And that's why it was found only in 2017, a few years after the PANSTAS survey started.
So when do you think do we have the necessary equipment on a scale that we were ready to observe the night sky for such small objects?
In less than 3 years, there would be a telescope called the Vera Rubin Observatory that would be extremely powerful, much more sensitive than PANSTARRS. It will discover all objects above 140 meters, 60% of them, not all, but 60%. So it's about two-thirds of the task that NASA was given. But it's the majority of those objects, and it could potentially find one or more like object every month. So it would be very exciting to see what it finds.
You know what I really like about that discussion, and I really like about your research, is that it's such a logic extension of the narcissistic modifications which Sigmund Freud, among others, pointed out, starting with Nicholas Copernicus, who expelled the Earth from the center of the solar system. Then Charles Darwin teaches us that man descends from the animal world and does not come from paradise. Then Sigmund Freud comes along, reveals to us that we may not be the masters of our own house, since a considerable part of the mental life is beyond the knowledge and control of conscious will. And then the only thing missing is number four now, discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence, which completely exercises our narcissistic exclusivity.
I completely agree with you. And what's most puzzling to me, I mean, that this is not a central theme of the mainstream science right now, because it's such an important question, perhaps the most fundamental question that will have a huge impact on society. And I just stumbled on it by chance because of Oumuamua, and I wrote this book. But then I was struck, and I told my wife, how come nobody notices the fact that it's a question that science can address with its tools? At the same time, scientists reject any discussion about it, and you know, they're ridiculing anyone that suggests looking into that. And all I'm suggesting is doing space archaeology, you know, looking for relics and finding more evidence. At the same time, there is no funding for that, and young people are discouraged because of all this acidic atmosphere. And so, you know, that's like unimaginable in the modern time, you know, a situation where there is no open mind to this possibility, which is actually, if you think about it, the most important question we can ask in modern science. So the most important question is ridiculed and not addressed.
It's not
when the public thinks it's the most important. That's the other thing. The public funds science and scientists are dismissing it. And here I come and I see this situation. It's just like the kid that said the emperor has no clothes. You know, it's something obvious. You see it. And everyone else is saying some other things, tweeting about other things. And I just fail to recognize, why is everyone ignoring the bare truth in front of us? And why isn't this like something that everyone is working on? And why isn't there much more funding for this? Why don't universities have a group working on this subject? Every university, not just one person in a remote university, but every university. Why does every university have people working on string theory? We don't have a clue that is correct. There is no contact with experiments. It's not even physics right now, because it's just mathematics. So that is considered part of the mainstream discussions of the multiverse. Something is wrong in the current culture of academia. And I just noticed that. And to me, it's obvious. It's a matter of common sense. And then I get this pushback. But the public does get it. And the proof is the book. I wrote it up in the book, put it out. You know, that's my first popular level book. And by the way, my publicist said, good job, Avi. You marketed the book so greatly. Now the book is extraordinarily successful. And I said, no, I was not marketing the book. You have to understand, I was not trying to sell the book. I told my publicist, It's not about selling more copies. I was basically trying to convey my message. And if the public wouldn't like my message, I wouldn't care less. If the book wouldn't sell, I don't care. I would give the same message. I'm not trying to tune my message just to the book. So the amazing thing is my message was received by the public and the public endorses it. 68% of the reviews on Amazon are 5 stars out of 5 for the book. Mm-hmm. 68%. Okay, I wrote it. You can't guarantee anything. It doesn't matter how much I market it. If people don't like the content, they would not give it 5 stars. So there is something in it that appeals to people. And if it appeals to people, that the public, it must appeal also to the young generation in the public. Mm-hmm. And those are the kids that will become scientists in the future. So how is it possible that the same kids turn into those tenured professors that eventually end up rejecting this premise? Mm-hmm. That to me is a puzzle. But my hope is that after these kids read my book, when they become the next generation of scientists, they will behave differently.
So what do you think is going wrong in the academia, in the academic world at the moment?
Right.
Is it an ivory tower mentality or
no?
What do you think?
Part of it is the fact that people in academia feel that it's a status symbol and they distance themselves from very popular, you know, low-level discussions. You know, that's, and if you have sophisticated math, it's even better. If the public cannot understand, it's even better because it shows that you are elevated somewhere. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more to do with people basically trying to perfect their image and make it such that they can get honors and awards. And that means that you need to follow a path that is consistent with what selection committees prefer. And it's a very conservative path and also a path that doesn't take a lot of risks and not much innovation. And basically you repeat mantras that you said for decades. You keep repeating. You have echo chambers of students and postdocs that repeat what you said to make your voice louder. And it's all about your image. And that's bad because it means that you're not taking risks. You're not putting any skin in the game. You know, kids put skin in the game. They get bruised, literally speaking. And when you try to explore the unknown, when you work on the frontiers, you have to take risks. You have, you know, making mistakes is inevitable. And if you are always thinking about avoiding mistakes so that your image will be perfect, then you will never make discoveries. You can get prizes, but you will be boring. And frankly, I don't want to be boring. I would like to learn something new. So for me, taking risks and not paying attention to how many likes I have on Twitter is a natural path, you know. And I think I enjoy the process much more and I have a chance of finding something nobody else found this way. But what's wrong in the current culture is that very few people take the approach of a kid. I would like my colleagues to behave more like kids, where you're not afraid to ask questions. You are exploring all possibilities without prejudice. You're open-minded and you're taking risks and innovating and you're asking, you know, you're going in directions that are not necessarily prescribed ahead of time and you're finding something new and without prejudice. And if we were more like kids, we would discover new things much faster. There are many examples in the modern science where the mainstream basically blocked progress. Even the discovery of planets around other stars. There was a proposal in 1952 by Otto Struve, an astronomer, saying if a Jupiter-like planet is next to a star like the Sun, very close to it, then it would move the star back and forth by a measurable amount. And if it will have a higher chance of crossing the face of the star if it's aligned properly. And therefore, we should search for such systems. And time allocation committees on telescopes refuse to give time to search for such systems because they said, we know that Jupiter is far from the Sun and we understand why. And it will be a waste of our telescope time to even search for such systems of hot Jupiters close to their stars. Mm-hmm. And it turns out in 1995, the first such system was found and it opened the whole field of exoplanets, planets around other stars. And the Nobel Prize was awarded for that a few years ago, for that particular discovery. Now you might say, okay, you know, no harm was done between 1952 and 1995. Eventually, you know, we found such systems. It was only 4 decades of lost time. I say, well, it reduces the efficiency of science. And moreover, I say, this is a baby that was born. Think about all the babies that were not born, that mm-hmm. were not postponed by 4 decades, but forever. Because mm-hmm. people said, there is no point in looking for these things forever. Like nothing was done about these proposals, and they were dismissed. So my point is, without risk-taking, without thinking outside the box, without allowing funding for such proposals, we are losing the health of the scientific endeavor, mm-hmm. the fun of discovery. And in the private sector, in the commercial sector, you do find big companies like Google, SpaceX, that are doing it for a profit. Open-minded, they have groups of people with blue sky research that think about ideas outside the box much more than you find in academia. And I find that really strange, because in academia, tenure is supposed to give you that freedom.
I took the liberty before our conversation we're having right now. I asked my 12-year-old daughter, I told her about you and I told her a little bit about your research. And I asked her, what would you like to ask Avi? And she said, I would like to ask him why he thinks that this rock is a spaceship and how he deduces his insights. Mm-hmm. And then I asked her, and what else would you like to know? Something about aliens? Then she said, no, not really. Aliens, I mean, like, what's the big deal about aliens? And I was like, wow, very interesting. That was very down to earth.
Exactly. No, that your daughter, okay, your daughter is the perfect scientist of the future, okay? So you should encourage her to pursue science, because she has exactly the right attitude. And because she's asking you, what is the evidence for what Avi is suggesting? And that's exactly how science should be done. Let's focus on the evidence. Is the argument convincing? If not, then let's collect more evidence. That's exactly what she's saying. And then she doesn't have a prejudice. Okay, if it's aliens, it's aliens. Okay, and then we live with it, because that's part
no
of
big the deal.
She's exactly the ideal scientist that I have in mind. Now, to answer her question, of course, I was driven to this because of the extra push that Oumuamua exhibited, that there was no cometary tail to give it that push. And then the only effect that I could think of is reflection of sunlight. And for that, you need the object to be very thin, like a sail. And as a result, I said, nature doesn't produce sails. It must be artificial. So it must be a very thin object. And we now know that another object, the rocket booster, behaved the same way that we mm-hmm. produce. So that's my point. And I'm not religious about it. I don't say that it must be that. But all I'm saying is that it's sufficiently intriguing for us to focus on future objects that are as weird as this one and get a photograph of them. And then I'm sure that your daughter would be convinced if she sees a picture, right? If it doesn't sure. look like a rock, sure. That's it.
Wonderful. Avi, I already mentioned Lisa Kaltenegger. I worked with her a couple of years ago, and we were talking about extraterrestrial life. And she said that from a technological perspective, we will know within the next 10 to 15 years if we're alone in the universe or if we're not, because now we have the technological abilities to make that observation. My conversation with Lisa was a couple of years ago. Is it still valid?
Yeah, I mean, I'm optimistic. Of course, you can't forecast the future, but it depends not just on us searching, but what is out there, you see. But my point is, if we are not open to discover new things, we will never discover them. So my main criticism right now is not enough resources are allocated for that search. And the culture is acidic, it's negative. And young people, fresh talent is not entering the search because people are afraid of the damage that will be inflicted on their job prospects. And that's not a good situation to be in. So my point is, if we will change this culture so that we will have much more funding and within the mainstream, people will be encouraged to work on this, then I think the chances are very good that within our lifetime, we will find evidence that space archaeology, if we deploy these cameras within the orbit of the Earth around the sun, I'm quite optimistic that we will uncover within a matter of years some plastic bottle out there.
Avi, what do you make of the current renaissance in space travel, in the space industry? What's going on at the moment? How do you feel about that?
So in the past, it used to be nations that were competing among themselves for national pride. And it still continues, you know, on Mars, NASA will land the Perseverance rover, and other nations like China and the United Arab Emirates will also have a mission to Mars around the same time. And so the national pride is still a driver of space missions. But now you have another component, which is the commercial sector. And companies like SpaceX or Blue Origins, they first of all launch communication satellites. But beyond that, they are thinking about going to Mars and the moon. And altogether, I think once you get to that kind of mode of operation where it's commercial benefit, then it will be more global. It will not be a matter of one nation trying to dominate relative to another, but more a matter of the global economy. And I think that's much healthier because people might collaborate across the globe on such missions. It will not be subject to national security issues and stuff like that. So the way and of course there is the even better situation of doing it for the sake of science, just not even a profit, but just for the future of humanity. And I very much hope that this will be the wave of the future, that we will do it because we are driven by curiosity, just like the explorers that left Europe to find the new worlds. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we will find new worlds.
In your dreams, Avi, what will an encounter with an extraterrestrial intelligence look like? What will
If I try to be as realistic as possible, I would think we would see a piece of equipment and at first take just a photograph of it, but then in the next case, we might actually land on it and try to explore what does it have on it and why and what was the purpose and why was
Could it be radically different from how we perceive the world? So, for example, would an alien spaceship have everything you would imagine from science fiction to be on a spaceship, or could it be radically different?
It could be completely different, radically different. Just think about the analogy with a beach. You know, if you walk on the beach and you see seashells and rocks, and does that give you any good sense of what you might find in a plastic bottle? Not at all. The plastic bottle is something completely different. And if you've never encountered the plastic bottle, you would never imagine it. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so my point is, it's an exploration. We should just look for something that doesn't look like a rock. That's the first thing. Once we find it, let's put our instruments on it and start to examine it and figure it out. And, you know, it's just like a detective story. You don't know until you find the clues. You don't know what you will find.
Is your research done when it comes to Oumuamua? Are you done
with
that?
Well, it's done in the sense that we cannot collect new data on it, but not in the sense of its implications. You know, I still write papers that relate to interstellar objects and what can we do with them and how can we find them. And, you know, just finished this book also talking about the implications for humanity. It's never done. Science is never done.
So towards the end of our show, we usually have a fun tradition because this is a space cafe podcast. It's a coffee place, so to say. And I would encourage you to share a quick inspiration for our minds, for the minds and ears of our audience. We call it an espresso, a space espresso. Without much thinking, what would you like to share when it comes to science, space travel, alien worlds, perhaps, that is? What would you like to share?
Well, it's the most interesting question to me is what started the Big Bang, okay? And because we can extrapolate back in time to the point where the universe started its expansion, but we don't know what happened before. And it's possible that the umbilical cord of our universe leads to a laboratory of an alien civilization that we would figure it out once we realize that we can create a baby universe in the laboratory at some point. Once we understand the unification between quantum mechanics and the general theory of relativity of gravitation. And so if we are able to design a machine that will create a baby universe in the laboratory, then that could explain where the Big Bang came from. It came from a laboratory of another civilization. And so you can, just like humans have babies that have babies that have babies, you know, you can imagine a sequence of universes that give rise to civilizations that make baby universes and continue. This process continues forever. And that would be amazing if true.
How does that feel to you? Is it menacing or encouraging?
Oh, nature is always inspirational. I never have a quarrel with nature. If nature gives me something, I really am delighted always. The only aspect of nature that I'm not happy with is humans. They frustrate me sometimes. But putting humans aside and looking at the rest of nature, I'm always happy with what I get.
Wow. Your daughter must be proud of you. How does she grow up with such a dad? So is she cool with aliens?
No, I mean, my wife says that if we ever have a spaceship land in our backyard where the aliens call me to go on board, that she wants just two things out of me. She wants me to leave the car keys with her and make sure that to ask them not to ruin the lawn in our backyard when they lift off.
Thank you so much, Avi. That's extremely inspirational.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Whether his theory turns out to be true or false, in my opinion, no thought may be illicit in our societies. No premise forbidden. Every thought must be allowed as long as it can be negotiated by society and science afterwards. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did today. By the way, have you seen our very cool Space Watcher t-shirts? If you like, head over to our store at spacewatch.global. And I know I'm repeating myself. If you like what we're doing here, please leave us a star or two, for example, on Apple Podcasts. And you know why? Because the internet doesn't understand any other language and because it keeps this podcast alive. So anyway, thanks for being here today. I look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.